This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
They're really making each bit of land that they touch much more profitable by using more sustainable practices. And really, I mean, for all of us who have to lean on farmers in order to get the food that we eat, that's what we want. We want somebody out there growing the stuff right.
Often when we cover agriculture, we look at what and how farmers are growing. But the infrastructure that undergirds every farm in America is finance. This week's guest on Sea Change Radio, author Dean Kuipers, explores how farms get the money they need to grow the food we eat. In his recently published Orion Magazine article, Buying the Farm, Kuipers picks apart the financial landscape of agriculture and compares financing for big agribusiness versus small, sustainable farming. Today, we delve into the different models for financing agriculture not only in the U.S., but globally, examine how one small San Francisco bank is backing sustainable farmers, and take a peek at how an Illinois-based organic bean farmer is getting a leg up on the competition. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Dean Kuipers. He's the author of Operation Bite Back and Burning Rainbow Farm, and his latest piece in Orion Magazine is entitled Buying the Farm. Dean, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Hey, Alex. Thanks for having me on.
We often hear about big business dictating what farmers grow, but we don't really hear a lot about the actual land that farmers grow their crops on. You do a terrific job of exploring that. Why don't you first take a step back and tell us traditionally how farmers have owned their land and how that's changing today?
Yeah, and we have to start right off by saying that really the traditional way is still the way most farmland is held. What we're talking about here in my piece is a phenomenon that's happening on a pretty small sliver of the farmland universe, but it's growing, and that's why people are concerned. So what's been happening is instead of people, generally local folks owning, you know, nobody can really be more local than a farmer. They own their own land, and lots of farmers lease land from their neighbors. They generally try to keep it pretty close because they got to get their farm equipment around and stuff like that. But what's been happening in the last decade or so is very large institutional investors have begun to regard farmland as a good place to park some of their money. So, you know, especially since the crash in 2008, I believe that single year investment jumped worldwide in farmland by about 200%. They're looking for a safe haven for their money, and as in one investor called it years ago, farmland is like gold with yield, meaning like gold, you own a property that has some speculative value that can go up or down, and you're hoping, of course, it'll go up. But while you're waiting for that to happen, you're also producing crops that you can sell. So those two things are very attractive to investors. Farmland prices and farm product or commodity prices themselves have been quite good in the past, you know, decade or so. So big institutional investors have been piling in.
And this is completely separate from the profitability of being a farmer, correct? That is to say, whether or not farmers make money on their crops, the investors can still make money with these vehicles.
Sure, because they're buying the land, and it would be pretty unusual that the price of their farmland would go down, so it's a pretty safe bet. What they, you know, institutional investors want to put their money in places where they know there's going to be, you know, steady but also pretty large profits involved. They don't really want to waste their time with something that's not going to make money. So the bet here is that the farmland price will go up, and that in the meantime, the crops that you grow on the land can be very profitable. And, you know, in the case of things like corn and soybeans, there's a very standard and huge market for these commodities. In cases like some more specialty crops like almonds, some of these things are just massively profitable right now.
And how has the Western drought affected these strategies for investors? Has it hampered it in any way?
Well, it's definitely put in some interesting twists, and it's one of the reasons that people are so upset about this. The farmland investing seems to be happening primarily in the Midwest, in those areas like Illinois and Iowa and, you know, Indiana, where there's just massive miles after miles after miles of row crop land. And the other place is really in California's Central Valley, where, you know, so many vegetables and specialty crops are grown. When we're talking about the drought in terms of California, one of the interesting stories that's come out is there are some big investors, including most notably TIAA CREF, which is that big retirement fund, which is, you know, has just huge amounts of money, are buying farms, to not only buying almond farms but putting in new almond farms right now in the middle of the drought. And almonds are pretty well known as being the most thirsty crops. I think the offhand estimate is that it takes a gallon of water to produce every single nut. And when they come into the land there, they are exercising their water rights to the aquifer water deep down below the Central Valley. In terms of water rights, if you own the land, you own the water under it, and they're digging super deep wells, and they're just tapping that aquifer water to produce the almonds. Now, there are other people who grow almonds, for sure, but people are pretty upset about this because of the prospect for, you know, further diminishing California's water supply in order to create the most profitable crops for export.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to author Dean Kuipers. His latest piece is Buying the Farm in Orion Magazine. So, Dean, let's move into the organic versus traditional farming and how there are new ways for investors to start backing these organic farmers.
Yeah, this is the good news. As with anything, this is an investment strategy, and it can be misused, and there can be a sort of bad absentee landlordism and that kind of thing. And there's also an upside, and that is there are a couple great new companies that are offering investors, right now accredited investors, meaning folks with $1 million or more in their accounts and, you know, the ability to spend larger amounts. But offering these accredited investors ways to invest and increase the amount of organic farmland in the country. That's why I really got into this piece. A couple years back, 2013, I was visiting Wendell Berry, and he said, I was just visited, in that inimitable Wendell Berry voice, I was just visited by David Miller from Iroquois Valley Farms. And he said, you may be interested in this, and he gave me his card, and so I called David Miller. And Iroquois Valley Farms is one of these companies that's using this strategy for sustainability, in that you can invest in Iroquois Valley Farms, and they use the money to buy farmland for a specific organic farmer who wants to either transition some land to organic or expand the organic land he already has, and then share the profits of those organic products with the company. It's a pretty amazing strategy. It's, you know, kind of slow, methodical work, but this is sort of the anti-Wall Street model. Miller's commitment is amazing. He will sell the land, but only sell it to the farmer, to the tenant farmer who is working on it. So after 7 years, the land is available to the tenant farmer to buy if he can afford it at regular market prices. But their commitment is to not sell it out from under him, to not force him to mine it. You know, oftentimes they use this term that they're mining it. Not force him to mine it by planting only, you know, soybeans or corn or things that are like these big commodity crops. The commitment on the part of the investor is quite deep. Yeah, the way Miller runs it, you're not even allowed to vote your shares until you've been in for 7 years. So they really don't, this is not what he's calling quote-unquote trading capital. This is deep investment capital that he wants to stay in the farmland for a long, long time, because he knows that's the way, that's the only way that organic farmers can make a living. Since they have to transition the land, that alone takes 3 years. So there has to be a long-term commitment in order to make organic farming possible. Then there are a couple other companies that I mentioned in the piece in Buying the Farm that are also doing some fantastic work. One out of San Francisco called Farmland LP. They have a couple large sort of real estate investment trusts that they're putting together. They buy land in California and in Oregon.
Besides the fact that they make it a practice to invest in organic and more sustainable agriculture, does their model differ in any other way?
Yeah. For instance, Farmland LP is interesting in that they have a farmland manager, Jason Bradford, who helps them strategize about what exactly they're going to do with this land. Obviously, this is the concern for the folks like Oakland Institute and others who have written some big reports on this farmland investing trend. They're afraid of the potential for abuse, for, you know, as I said, absentee landlordism and bad farming practices. Farmland LP goes in, finds very specific pieces of property, decides how they're going. They have a whole strategy involved for actually doing sustainable farming, where, you know, they rotate the crops and they do the smart things that farmers of old would probably do naturally, but by keeping certain things in grass and basically not putting all of the land into, you know, high production row crops and not using conventional methods, but in mixing in livestock, using organic farming, basically taking good care of the land. And their manager, or their CEO there, Craig Wishner, is a really interesting guy, one of my favorite guys to talk to in this story. And he was a real estate guy before he got into this. Definitely saw an opportunity not only to do good, but make money doing good. And he is very enthusiastic about what's been happening. His company is about 6 or 7 years old. And he says they're, you know, they're really making the each bit of land that they touch much more profitable by using more sustainable practices. And really, I mean, for all of us who have to, you know, lean on farmers in order to get the food that we eat, that's what we want. We want somebody out there growing the stuff right. And it seems like these companies, so far anyways, are invested in growing things right.
And how does Farmland's profitability compare to some of the big Wall Street firms?
They're doing very well. I mean, you know, somebody can be giving me false numbers, but I don't think that they are. A fellow named Philip LaPerouse, who works for HighQuest Investors, those are some folks who put on big AgriVest conferences all over the world. These are the guys who are sort of in the vanguard of leading the charge worldwide to invest in farmland. He tells me that these regular conventional farmland investment schemes generally make between 7 and 12% returns. And those are the same kind of returns that both David Miller at Iroquois Valley and Craig Wishner at Farmland LP tell me that they're making. So they're very comparable.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to author Dean Kuipers. His latest piece in Orion Magazine is called Buying the Farm. So, Dean, you write about how these large-scale investors have really kind of ramped up their efforts to look at, is it called agrovesting?
Yeah, that's one of the things. Yeah, it's one of the little terms, agrovesting.
So, for example, pension funds, university endowments, big banks, hedge funds, they're pouring money into U.S. farmland. Do you see the other side of the coin, the farmlands out of San Francisco, these investors who are focusing on sustainable and organic farmers, do you see their success perhaps bleeding into or leading the charge for some of these deeper pocketed interests to start looking that way as well?
Sure. When you're a big investor like, say, UBS Agrivest, which is a division of one of the biggest banks in Switzerland, what matters is really the profits. And they come in with large pieces of money. Like, usually they won't even invest in farmland unless they can put in, you know, $50 million at a shot, that kind of thing. They just want to see the numbers. And if now Farmland LP, it's a little bit of a bigger operation than Iroquois Valley. They already closed one $50 million REIT, as they call it, our real estate investment trust. And now they have a $200 million one that is available now for investors. So suddenly these are big enough to where some of these institutional investors can start sniffing around at them. And if they see that they're making the similar kind of money that they need, they're probably going to load in.
So let's put a face to these farmers. You do an excellent job of profiling Ross Wilkin, who's a farmer out of Illinois who grows black beans. But these are organic black beans. How does his model stack up compared to some of the bigger agribusinesses, the GMO farmers of the world, if you will? His crops fetch more on the market, but they also probably cost more. From a finance perspective, why is Ross Wilkin interesting?
Yeah, these guys have a very interesting operation going on, and I really look at it as something that's possibly a model for other people out there. They are a classic family farm. It's Harold Wilkin is the father. He was a conventional farmer for a number of years in near Danforth, Illinois. I went out to visit them, a number of years back. A neighbor there got him interested in trying some organic farming, and he immediately started to transition all of his stuff to organic. And Ross is his son, who went to the University of Illinois and got a degree in agriculture, and now is part of the family farm. And now a brother-in-law is involved, and then a cousin is involved, and a guy down the street jumped in with them, with his land. It's a growing enterprise. Their model is different in that they're surrounded by the GMO sort of conventional farmers. And really, no matter what kind of crops they're growing, it's really conventional is the term. And every year they spray their fields with fertilizer and, you know, herbicides. And they put in their row crops, and they kind of sit back and watch it grow. The Wilkins have more of a challenge because they don't spray their crops, and they don't spray their herbicides. But I was out there, and I looked at their fields, and the black bean fields is right across the street from a one-lane dirt road from the neighbor's soybean crop, and they look the same. They take good care of their farms, and possibly even that they're benefiting from the fact that the weeds have been, you know, mostly suppressed around that area.
So productivity is comparable.
It's comparable. I have heard from many farmers that the yields will be a little lower in organic farming than they will be in conventional farming. But I loved talking to Harold, who's a really no-nonsense guy. I strongly suspect he wouldn't be doing this if it wasn't something that was profitable. But he says, you know, he loves going into the, you know, for years the farmers all around him kind of made fun of him because he was the kooky guy who was going to do organics, and the other thousands of farmers around there, none of them did that. But now he says he loves to walk into the local gas station or the local cafe, and he's just waiting for somebody to say, "Hey, Harold, what's the price of corn?" And then he tells them, and it's way better than their price, and it just kind of kills the whole room. You know, in a lot of ways, he's getting the last laugh, but he also is a very generous guy and really wants, one of the things that I loved in my piece was that he said he wants there to be more farmers when he's done than there are when he started, meaning he doesn't want to put anybody else out of business. He wants everybody to be farming. And more people show up at his place and you know, wander into his barn with their hands in their pockets and say, "So, you know, Harold, tell me about how you do this." And that's a kind of a revolution, you know, that's how things change.
And he's selling a food product, which is not one that he can really make a bulk of his sales from a farmer's market. These are often items that we find at a restaurant or canned. Talk about the impact that some of the larger buyers like a Chipotle have had on somebody like Harold's business.
Yeah, it's really interesting. This is an important distinction. I'm glad you brought that up, in that farmers like Harold Wilkin, I mean, he's farming 2,300 acres. That's not what you think of generally when you think of an organic farmer. You mostly think of somebody with like 7 acres who's growing vegetables that go straight to the farmer's market for a produce market. Or they're growing a small orchard of stone fruit, or they, you know, something on a smaller scale.
And that's what you would see at a farmer's market a lot of times, right?
That's right, yeah. So the Wilkins, they're not producing food for that market. They're producing like the big food. That's always been one of the arguments that, you know, people tell you is when you start talking about organics, you say, well, people tell you, well, we still have to feed the world, so we need these large farms to grow like massive amounts of corn and soybeans and things for cattle feed and so forth. Well,
and we can only do that with fossil fuel-based fertilizer.
Right. Correct. And the Wilkins totally put that to the lie, because this is exactly what they do. They're farming 2,300 acres last time I saw them and looking for more. That's big scale farming. It's all over the county. They grow a massive amount of food. And their beans, their black beans in particular, which is one of the things that they grow, are sold up in Munger, Michigan, by a fairly new entity up there, which is recruiting folks to grow organic because they need organic beans, and a lot of those beans go to Chipotle. It's really amazing that for all the things people may say or not say about Chipotle, that has a lot of power, because these guys, they can't get enough organic beans. And so people in Michigan, where my family is from, and guys like Harold Wilkin and Ross Wilkin are converting their farms to grow beans because they can't get enough and the prices are good.
Beans and cornbread. Beans and cornbread. Beans and cornbread. Beans and cornbread had a fight. Beans knocked cornbread out of sight. Beans. Cornbread said, "Now that's all right. Beans. Meet me on the corner tomorrow night. I'll be ready. Cornbread, you ain't straight. Beans. You better wake up or I'll gas you gate. Been in this pot since...
Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Presidio Graduate School in San Francisco, offering MBA and MPA degrees in sustainable management. Learn more at presidio.edu.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to author Dean Kuipers. His latest piece in Orion Magazine is called Buying the Farm. So, Dean, how unique is this to the U.S.? Are these organic farmers and their investment vehicles springing up outside of the U.S.?
Yeah, this is a global phenomenon, and it's really only kind of come back to the United States now, probably in a little bit of a flight to quality. There was a report, interesting report, from this group called the International Land Coalition, whose offices are out of Italy, who monitor this stuff, that between 2000 and 2011, deals were in place for over 500 million acres in places like Africa, South America, and Asia by big investors. 500 million acres is a lot of land. It's 8 times the size of Britain. Now, some of those deals are still in play. Those aren't things where people just walk in, buy it, and say, "There you go, we just bought, you know, 500,000 acres or something." So there's actually a group called the Land Matrix. They're at landmatrix.org. They have a very interesting interactive map that shows all these land deals globally that are going on. And the problem with these land deals, a lot of them, was they were just completely unregulated. U.S. investors, Chinese investors, Indian investors, people looking to shore up their domestic food supply over the last couple decades could go to Africa and go to, you know, wherever, Uganda or somewhere, and say, we need 10,000 acres of land where we can grow corn or something, and buy it from a local government. And then suddenly now this is their land, but that was land a lot of times where locals were already growing crops, already running livestock, already doing, you know, community, using it for community-based services like gathering firewood. And suddenly those people are excluded from that land, and now, you know, a U.S. or Chinese or Indian or Canadian firm or something now owns it, and they're putting in a, you know, palm oil plantation or something like that. So there were a lot of sort of very sketchy deals that were done, usually not done with local people in mind, and sometimes they didn't even hire the local people to help run it. The UN actually just recently, in October of 2014, just put out some rules for responsible agricultural investment, as they called it. A lot of the same groups like the International Land Coalition and Land Matrix and so forth have been howling about that, because they still see that despite the UN's rules and so forth, that a lot of this stuff is mostly just set up for land grabs by large companies. And that's been going on for quite a long time. This is one of the elements that make people look very negatively at international investment in farmland. But now, given that there are some of those opportunities may be becoming a little more elusive, and land control may be tightening up a little bit internationally, some of those companies have now come home, so to speak, to the U.S., even though they may be from Switzerland or Canada, and are looking for land in the U.S. because it's much more stable. The rule of law applies, and they may not be getting themselves into so much trouble trying to buy the land.
Dean Kuipers, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Alex, I really enjoyed it. Thanks so much.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Wes Montgomery, Little Feet, and Louis Jordan. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.